Continuing our discussion with John Harry Turan, learning about the secrets, the mysteries of the universe, and the way you describe them, John, they're no longer mysterious for us, they're no longer secrets. They're things that we can understand, and they're of a practical nature for us. They're things that we can apply in our lives. So keeping in line with that, I want to continue asking you questions. And one of the things that you and I have talked about is conversations that you can have with people who have crossed over. And certainly there are TV shows recently that have popularized this idea of communicating with what they would call the dead, or people who have crossed over, gone to the other side, people who have left us in this physical form and are no longer with us in this three-dimensional world. So I want to ask you, John, what would be the practical applications that we can take from an ability to communicate with those who have crossed over?
Help. I think we can get a lot of help, and that is a very practical thing. In fact, to me, that's not a mysterious thing anymore. It's like I'm standing in this room, and there is somebody in the other room, and the door is closed, and I'm not permitted to get up and walk through that door until I spend my last minute here in this room. But I know there's someone in that room, and I can contact that person by telephone or by shouting real hard or getting into a special feeling situation in my mind, and the person will sense me. I do not believe that all of a sudden we get here, we got here totally fully formed. We live for 60 or 80 or 90 or 100 years, and we get tired and we get old and we get feeble, and then we die. And that mind, which was brilliant, whether it be the mind of an Einstein or even a horrid thinking mind like the mind of Jack the Ripper, that mind just is totally gone, and all they left was just some notes and books or some tapes or whatever. I don't think that's so. I think life is forever. There's something within me. I don't have to read that in books, and I don't have to study that. There's a little something in me that tells me this is so. Now, I'm sure there are others who would say to me, John, there's something in me tells me that's not so. Well, that's okay. For you, it's not so. For me, it's so. So I choose my way because it seems a lot more fun to me. But I don't think that in a universe that's been put together so beautifully, so precisely, with such vast distances, the macrocosm, and such tiny distances, the microcosm, like the distance between an electron and the nucleus of that atom, being like such a tiny distance. They measure them in what we call angstrom units, which not billionth, but probably more of a centimeter. And I can't believe from the smallest to the largest, where we measure things in light years, millions of light years, which means a million light year is how far would light travel, if it travels, which it does, at 186,000 miles a second. How far would it travel in a year? That's one light year. How far would it travel in a million years? That's far, very, very far. So I believe, like one of the poets said, a certain murmur in the soul tells of a world to be. As travelers hear the billows roll before they reach the sea. I have lost a lot of people. By losing, I don't mean it like they're misplaced. A lot of people who were very close to me passed on, died. My father, my mother, my wife, a sister, a bunch of aunts and uncles, my grandparents, and some very close friends. And yet, I don't feel they're gone. I don't think they're here sitting down and saying, okay, we're going to watch over John, and we'll be at his beck and call. I don't think that's how it happens. I think they've got work to do wherever they are, just like I do. But I think there's a connection between us that if I think deeply about it, I'll be in touch with them. And I remember a dream. I might have mentioned this before, but it bears mentioning again. A dream I had after my dad had died, and I had written the book called When You Can Walk on Water, Take the Boat. And the dream was, like we talked about a few things. I saw him in this dream, and he said to me, when you are puzzled about things and you do not know what to do, let's meet again in the little village where you grew up, by the little river underneath the tamarind tree, and we'll talk about it. Over the many years since he has been gone, I remember those words, and they serve as a comfort to me. And when I go through some really tough times, I may get real quiet within myself, and I'd say, Dad, where are you? I need your help. And of course, no one says, hey, I'm here, son. But I might be doing something totally simple an hour or two later, and I feel the presence of this wise personality who raised me from a kid to a grown man. And I'd hear his voice in my head say, you know, I don't think you ought to go that way. I think you ought to look at this. And then I'd start thinking, and I'd look around, and the feeling that he was there is now gone. But I got the message, and when I follow through on what he suggested, it worked out perfectly, perfectly great. And so it is with other things to this day. It's like, you know, play a game with ourselves. Let's do this. Say, we build, everybody talks about Napoleon Hill's mastermind group. And so years ago, I got together my mastermind group. And you know who I had on my mastermind group? I had imaginary figures who had existed in history. I had Gandhi, I had Lincoln, I had Einstein, and I had my dad, I had others. And when I feel I really needed high power advice, I'd sit down and I'd say, I want my group to gather. And whether it's my imagination or not, it doesn't matter. The results are brilliant. The problem with me is I don't do it often enough. And so that's what I think about past lives, future lives, current life. I think it might be just one whole thing, and that they are being lived in different timelines, but simultaneously.
I think that sums it up very nicely, John. I appreciate you putting it so succinctly, as you always do. Now, I want to ask you about the cloak of invisibility. I know you talk about this, and I know you talk about the power of silence. And my understanding is that we can use these concepts to sort of have more privacy, to kind of blend in. And some people do this without even trying to do it. They just kind of blend in anyway. They become non-memorable, and people don't remember meeting them. And I want you to talk about how we can practically use this technology.
Again, it's to get some space and time to ourselves. It could serve you very well in danger also. Let's say you were being chased by a mugger. I hate this example, but I want to use it for effect. And you're running through this dark alley, and all of a sudden you decide you are going to put on your cloak of invisibility, which is just my name for it, to make it recognizable. You just stop, and you get really quiet within yourself, and 9 times out of 10, this person will pass right by you, looking for you and not noticing that you're there. Because what you have done, we're all like little candlelights, and our minds control that or manage that. And so he sees this light, and he's running after him to get you, to mug you, to steal your stuff. And what you do, you just put that cloak of invisibility on. You just slow down your thinking. Now, that's very difficult to do during those moments. However, if people, and I know a few people who do that, who actually can do it under the most stressful conditions, and it always works for them. For me, it works many times. Other times when I remember, when I don't remember to use it, it doesn't happen. It has to be a conscious way of dropping the noise in your mind, because that noise is broadcasting right away, simultaneously, to all the parties around you, to everybody. Now, some of them, many of them, don't have their radios tuned into it or their receivers. But there are those who can pick up your thoughts or your vibrations, if you will. And so the cloak of invisibility is nothing more than getting extremely silent and not disturbing the environment around you with your thoughts or with the feelings of fear. Actually, if you can manage fear at those point, or you are just, let's not even say it's a dangerous situation. You're sitting at a place where there are all kinds of people and they come up to you. One wants to know the time, the other one wants to know the direction to something. And these are good things. If you can, please do help people. But after a while, you are so tired and you want to take a little nap and you're scared. If I nap here, oh my God. Goodness, somebody could steal my cell phone. Somebody could steal whatever it is. Well, times like that, when you are sitting on a bench in the middle of a mall and you get really quiet and you only observe, then you will notice that people pass right by you. It's a funny little game to play. People could actually start practicing by doing this. You just sit there and you'll see people pass right by you. They don't even look at you. You do not exist. To them, you are invisible, but you can see everything that's happening. That's a good use for the cloak of invisibility.
I think that's a very powerful use and wonderful advice. Thank you for that. John, moving on, I want to talk about dreams. And I know that you and I have talked about dreams. I'm wondering if you can tell me a practical use for analyzing our dreams. We're able to analyze our dreams. There have been books written on dreams and what water means and what a wall means and what a birth means and so forth. So there have been a lot of attempts to sort of make it a generic thing, just look it up and find out what it means. But I was wondering if you can tell us a practical use of interpreting our dreams and listening to our dreams and tuning into them.
Glad you asked that question, Steve, because I think dreams are unique to the individual who has these dreams. For example, symbols are different for different people. Now, granted, there are some universal symbols. For example, if you were to dream of a sheaf of wheat, maybe, a bundle of wheat, that signifies affluence or prosperity. Or if you were to dream of water, depending on the type of water, if it's muddied water, it shows a muddy situation. If it's clear and cool, it looks like things are clearing up. So each one has certain universal symbols, and then their personal symbols. Now, the best person to interpret your dream is actually yourself. And one of the simplest ways to start, because we all dream anyway, so, and many people don't think they do, but they do. They just don't remember them. And the best way to remember what you thought you dreamt or dreamed or what you really dreamed is when you get up in the morning, the first 30 seconds, just check how you feel. Do you feel like you want to sing or whistle or dance or jump up and it's going to be a great day and you feel so alive, or do you feel down? Or that you are dismayed and you're fearful. These came from the dream. It doesn't mean that's what's going to happen. It means by the time the meaning of the dream filtered down to your consciousness, it has been translated and translated and translated again. So I think the best way to interpret those is to ask yourself, what do you think you feel about this? And you'd be amazed if you keep doing this and trusting it that the dream will start telling you what it means. And if you don't get it the first time, don't worry about it. The dream will keep coming back in different ways until you finally get it. So I think dreams also guide us. Dreams guided the Native American to water holes, and the Aborigines of Australia talk about the dream time and how they can dream this or that and could do things that modern or the West had never seen. And it's all done in the dream time. And we'd understand that if we understand that dreaming reality is different from waking reality. And there is no real hard and fast border between the two. They blend into each other just like at daylight or at noontime. The stars are still in the heavens, but you can't see them. They're still in the sky. It's only when it gets dark and the sun goes down that you could see them. But they didn't go away in the morning. They just sort of faded into the background. So while I'm talking with you here now, there's probably a very active dream life going on, except I don't recall it because we're focused on this waking moment, in this present. There are those who can do both. I've been amazed at meeting a guru or two who, while talking with me, would stop for about like 3 seconds and say, good, I'm sorry. Go ahead, I got it. Somebody was talking to me. I mean, that could be unnerving, but it works.
Very well put, John, and thank you so much for that. You know, switching gears a little bit, I want to talk about distance healing. And many people have loved ones and they would like to be able to remotely help them. They'd like to be able to reach out, not just with a card when they get sick, but with some actual practical help, the ability to potentially heal them. And I'm wondering, how can someone do that? How can someone hear that a loved one or anyone is hurting or is sick and offer them some healing energy that will actually help them get better?
When someone is sick or hurting or in really bad physical situations, our first impulse is to sort of commiserate with that person, feel really sorry with and for this person. And that's wonderful. It shows how human we can be. But while we're doing that, that person is picking up our worry and our concern and our feelings, and it's making his or her worse. So the best thing we can do for that person is to say a few kind words, think of them lovingly, and to see them whole. My old friend who wrote the book called Spiritual Economics, Eric Butterworth, he used to say, don't try to set it right, just see it right. Because seeing comes from an ancient Sanskrit word which has the meaning of fountain, or the eye being at the top of the fountain, where you can convey energy just by seeing it in your mind's eye. See them whole, bless them. Don't think, oh my God, goodness, that was a terrible diagnosis. Look at what's going to happen now. What am I going to do? My friend is suffering. No, just say, hey, my friend may be suffering temporarily, or my family member, but I know something that I don't tell a lot of people. You know, one of the problems too is we tell everybody these things. And as we do that, everybody jumps in to demagnetize what was actually a very good thing. I don't tell people too much about my ability to do some of this healing, because 3/4 of them would laugh, and the other 1/4 of them would be on me every day to, can you do this? Can you do that? And I think we all should learn to. But I do. And just this past week, I brought into my thinking area or feeling area 3 or 4 people who desperately needed help from having sick relatives. And I just didn't deal with the sickness. I'm not into dealing with sickness. I'm into dealing with life. And life is forever, and life is whole, and life cannot be sick. It's only the body, which is not me, but a part of me. Only the body could get that way. So I created the condition in my mind where I see this person recovering and becoming whole. Now you might say to me, Steve, well, does this always work? And my answer would be, well, it should, but it doesn't. There are times when it's someone who is a lot closer to me than some other people. And the ones who are a lot closer to me are harder to deal with because I'm so emotionally tied to them, okay? If it's my son or my daughter, it becomes a little tougher. But I have learned over the years to draw a line and distance myself from their misery. Just 2 days ago, my daughter rarely ever gets sick, but everybody seemed to have gotten a cold. And she was sniffling and coughing and everything. And I said, remember? I just told her this again, because I always remind her of it. I said, remember when you were a little baby girl, and as you grew up to a little girl, I used to tell you when you were ill to just send it away, and it'll go away. I said, why don't you just send this away, it'll go away. The next day she called me, her fever had gone, her cold had gone because she believed that since she was a little girl. And what I did, I removed myself from the equation about worrying. Maybe she should go to the pharmacy and she should pick this up, or she should go to the doctor. No, I just said she doesn't really need that. And if she does, always leave a door open. If she does, she'll go get that, or I'll go get it for her. So let me just see her whole and happy and smiling and laughing again. She talked to me yesterday. She was well. She talked to me today. She's doing very well. And this is how I think we can help those who are ill. Instead of being like, you know, you see someone in the ditch suffering and you jump in the ditch and suffer with them and, you know, play in the mud with them. Instead of saying, oh, no, you shouldn't be in there. I'm so sorry you fell in. Let me give you a hand out or a hand up. And you join with them in thinking wonderful healing thoughts.
John, very well put as always. And I appreciate that, you making it practical, because it's something that seems so metaphysical and lofty and so out of reach for some people when they hear about distance healing, the ability to heal someone from a distance. And you make it into such a practical concept for us, something that's useful. So thank you for that. You know, John, in many of our conversations, you have talked about problems being similar to clouds and how you can vaporize clouds and you can vaporize problems. I was wondering if you could sum up your philosophy on that and give us something practical that we can use when we face problems or challenges, as I often call them, and we're interested in vaporizing them.
I think it's a good exercise to practice vaporizing of clouds, and I used to know about that since I was a child. I'd lie down under a tree and look up at the clouds, and then they'll disappear. And then it became like, ah, that's so easy to do. And then I thought, here's a blue sky. We can bring clouds into it, and then clouds will appear. This is not magic, you know. And if one thinks it's magic, it's no more magic than when I took the first Polaroid camera I had into the village where I was born, and I took somebody's picture, and they saw it in about a minute, and word went through the village, come see the man with the magic camera. And I took a nap, and when I woke up, there was a line of about 100 people wanting me to take their pictures with the magic camera. It was magic for them because they didn't know about how it happened. They were so used to one or two cameras that existed. They took a picture, and it was a week or two or three or four before they saw the picture. So it is with this. You could practice to relax by looking at clouds and just thinking of them away. Not hitting them with a ray or anything, because whether there's a ray or not, I don't know. But I know what you do. You see through the clouds. See beyond the clouds to the beautiful blue sky. And if you do it quietly and you feel it, you will notice that as you're looking, you're actually seeing the blue sky and the cloud is no longer there. Now, that to me is very closely related, or maybe a good example of a problem. A problem is a cloud in our life. And because we look at the problem from every point of view and every side, and we only see the difficult parts of it, the problem stays with us. It's like we are saying, don't go, I love you, because you make me miserable, and I'm trying to solve you. And the more you try to solve it, the bigger the problem becomes. Just like a cloud, the more you try to vaporize it, the larger it'll get. But I remember the examples of those of friends who told me they do this too, where when they remove their focus from it for a little while and they just feel it gone, it disappears. And the same is true for problems. And I know, because I've heard it before, that people will say, get real, John. And my answer is, I don't want to, because if I do, I'll be just like you. But I didn't want to insult anybody, so I don't say that. I say it in my mind. I don't want to get real, because real is relative. I want to be me and use these things that my heart and my soul know work for me and for those I have shared these things with. You know, if I were to name some names of people who cause clouds to disappear, the audience would know them. Some of them are household names. Many of my friends do this as a little exercise. That's exactly what you do with problems. You think of problems as clouds. Some of them are big, heavy rain clouds, storm clouds, thunder around them. Some of them are just little bitty brown clouds, and others are white clouds. Just like our problems. Big, heavy, small, little, but the same principle works in them. And that's my idea of how to use cloud vaporizing in a very practical way.
Well, I think that is very practical and, as always, very much to the point and something we can put into play in our lives right away. John, as we wrap up here, I'd like to end on a note that I know appeals to many people because so many people are interested in money. And that doesn't mean that they're greedy. That means that they would like to learn how to get money to have a comfortable life or to have perhaps a few more toys or to just do the things that they want to do. And many times it's not a matter of just hoarding money to have money. It's a matter of having money to help loved ones and to contribute to charities and to be able to give back. So I want you to, as we wrap up here, talk about the metaphysics of money and just give us some practical pointers how we can attract money into our lives.
Okay, I'll try to make it short because I could talk for a couple of hours on that one. First thing about money is not a thing as much as it's a state of mind. It has its bearings and it's related to the law of attraction. It also has to do with fear because we try so hard to get money that money always try to run away from us. When we stop and we don't, so to say again, the divine, don't give a damn attitude about it, the not being attached to outcomes, it'll stop running, it'll stay there, and then we can gently approach it and it'll come to us and we'll have money. The other thing is to get rid of the fear that without the money you are doomed. Because that's not totally true. It might appear that way. And to get to the point to realize that you are worthy of it. Notice all the things that have to do with money have to do with not working hard or trying hard or the amount of education or lack of or anything. It's to do with simple things. And then another thing, always being grateful. Being a gratitude creates money. I don't know how it does it. And I frankly don't care. Joe Vitale wrote a book called The Greatest Money-Making Secret in the World. And it's based on that. I think I wrote the introduction for it. And it tells some very good stories about giving and gratitude. People think this way, Steve. They say, you know, I'm going to give and help others when I have enough. And as a result, they never have enough. But if they turn around that and do something which is less intuitive, which seems less natural and normal, and they say, the little I have, I will give from that, there would be so much abundance. There was a time when after my wife's death and I had my two kids and the money was very, very scarce. And I don't remember the exact thing now. It's been told over and over again. So we'll say I had $10 in my pocket, okay? And I'm driving by going to the supermarket. No, it was $5. And I'm thinking, I got to buy milk and I got to buy bread. But I don't think I have enough money to do both. But I think maybe if it's on sale, I'll get both. And as I'm driving, I saw this man and his wife and a young child and a baby sitting on the grass next to the road and the curb. And the guy held up a sign which says, "We'll work for food." And I looked at them and I thought, my heart went out to them. And you know what you do in cases like that? I was at the stoplight and I looked at them and my eyes caught his. And it was like such sad eyes saying, please help me and my family. But I only had 10 bucks, okay? So I just am praying, God, please let the light change. I got to move. I can't stand his look. I can't give him anything because I don't have enough. And so the light changed and I pulled off. And about three or four blocks later, I couldn't do it. I turned around and I came back and I drove up to him and I gave him $5 from what I had. I had $2 dollar bills, I think. I gave him $5 and I said, okay, here you guys, go take that. He was going to thank me. I just drove away. I went to the supermarket and I said, okay, I have enough for milk and maybe not bread. Tomorrow we'll get bread. At least the kids will have some milk. That's how things were bad at one time. As I got to the supermarket, it started raining a little. And I stopped, got out of my car, And as I put my foot down, I almost slid and fell. And I looked at what I slid on, and it was a $20 bill. And I said, oh my goodness. Sometimes the law of giving works immediately. And at other times, it takes forever. This time, it worked immediately. I immediately picked it up, looked around to see if there's somebody I could find to give it to. There was nobody there. So I went to the store and I bought milk and I bought bread and a few other things and I drove home. Do you think that if I had just gone on directly to the store, that $20 might have been there? No. The timing was right. I fulfilled a major, major law, the law of giving. And as I gave, I got back many more times than I give. And that's what I think about money. You got a little of it, give as much of that away as you can. You will find that you cannot outgive the universe. If you take $5 and you plunk it down and say to the universe, there, you got $5. You give it away to somebody. The universe looks at you and smiles and later on plunks down $20 and say, huh, you think you're that good. Give away 20, you'll end up with a few hundred. Give away a few hundred, you'll end up with a few thousand. Give all of it away, and guess what? The universe says, you never could do that because I got more than you. Here, have a lot more. That's my thought about money, Steve. And I hope your audience or our audience appreciates some of this.
Oh, absolutely. I'm just taking in, you know, I get, this is kind of perhaps odd to say, but I get goosebumps when you talk. It just, and that only happens to me when I'm hearing something that's just true. It's resonating with my body, with my spirit, with my entire being, and I just understand it to be true. And that's what happens every time you talk. So I'm sure they're receiving this. I'm sure they're getting it. I'm sure they're going to apply it. So thank you so much, John.
Well, I'm honored. I really am. And it has been a delightful adventure sharing with the audience some of these things.
Well, thank you so much. And John Harry Charan, where can people learn more about you?
From the universe? No, I'm kidding. there is a, if they want a copy of some of my books for free, go to the website called Insight, Insight 2000. That's Insight 2000, the numerals, Insight2000.com. And you get a lot of free stuff there. You'll see some interviews. You'll see interviews with my friend Brad Steiger, the UFO guy, the paranormal guy. You'll see there's one with Deepak Chopra and Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and stuff. And you get free things, lots of goodies.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, John. And thank you for continuing to give to us and to give to the universe. And of course, it's all going to come back to you. Thank you so much for sharing.
It was my pleasure, Steve. Thank you for tolerating me for all these hours of talk.
John, it's an absolute honor. And on behalf of myself, Steve G. Jones, and my good friend, John Harry Turan, we wish you an outstanding life.